behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. We are joined by our super producer, Noel the Movement Brown, and, of course, by you, ladies and gentlemen, the most important and coolest part of this show. Scott, before we get started, this has nothing to do with anything.
Okay, hang on a second.
What's that?
We can't let this pet the movement. Is he going to like that name?
I don't know.
I guess we'll have to run that by him before we publish, because
It's very ambitious.
It is. Yeah, it is. It is. Interesting. Okay.
It's sort of like The Edge.
Oh, okay.
In U2.
All right, now I get it.
So, apropos of nothing, my friend, you may notice that I have a nifty new coffee holder, thermos.
Very slick. You just revealed the branding to me. Mm-hmm. It is a Cadillac thermos.
Yes.
How'd you get that?
It's not really mine. I think they give it to people when they buy Cadillacs, and my father purchased a Cadillac, so I came along with a bunch of caddy swag.
Wait, now is this a new Cadillac, or is this one the one prior?
This is the one prior.
Oh, okay.
Just, you know, my parents don't even drink coffee, but don't worry, I'm making up for their absence.
And you just decided to swipe that from their kitchen drawers or something, right? I mean,
well, we're at that stage where every time that I visit them, and listeners, you've probably been at this stage too with your parents or maybe with your kids. Every time I visit my parents, they give me things.
Oh yeah,
you know, here, yeah. take this thermos.
Yeah.
Here,
I'm sure you got room in your one-bedroom apartment.
Right. Do you need another ottoman?
Yeah, they're trying to empty out their giant home and stuff it all into your apartment.
and I do appreciate it, but I did want to say it was nifty. I feel a little bit classier, you know?
That is a pretty nice mug. I mean, it's classy, Ben. It's classy.
Thank you.
It's a lacquered black thermos type mug. Mm. I guess thermos is a brand name, I know, but it's a coffee mug.
Insulated beverage holder. It's like the folks at Frisbee.
Coffee container.
Did you ever hear about that?
No.
So the makers of Frisbee products are very, very protective of that name. Hmm. Anything that is not a Frisbee can only be referred to as a flying disc.
Oh, you know,
and they're
what?
Quite litigious.
I have heard about this before. And, you know, there was a place, there's some history there with pie tins. It's all part of it. And Kleenex, of course, and Jell-O brand. And, you know, there's other brands that are pretty particular about what can be called that. Towels, I guess, is another one. I didn't know Frisbee was one, though.
Lava Lamp is huge into that as well. You could almost say they're cult-like in their dedication.
Oh, I like it, Ben. I like it.
Womp womp.
Yeah.
Hey, but a little bit of administrative business before we get started. Off air earlier, you had mentioned that you have an important tip for our listeners.
Oh, I don't know about important, but just something I've been thinking about for a long time. And this is something that it's pretty clever, and it was passed on to me from somebody else, and I feel like it's my duty to pass this on as well. If you are somebody who regularly pays for your gasoline with a debit card or credit card at the pump, there's this simple trick that will help you when it comes time to review your bill at the end of the month, you know, your credit card bill, to quickly realize, like, well, because you think back and you think, well, what, did I spend $27.38 at the gas station on last Tuesday? Well, here's my simple trick for this. Always end your gasoline purchase with a 5.
Mm.
You round it up. Like, you know, you can bump a little bit more fuel in, once it's totally full. Do that every time up to the point where the last number, the last digit on that screen is a 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get your bill, every time you see, racetrack or, mobile gas or whatever.
Quick Trip, Stuckey's. Yeah, there's a Bolin's, actually.
A Bolin's, really?
Somewhere out there.
So anytime you're at Bolin's and you're pumping the gas, a quick read down your bill, it saves you a ton of time in trying to remember if that's your charge or if that's a legitimate charge. Because I've had several relatives that have been kind of ripped off, I guess, by credit card scanners. Or what do they call that?
Skimmers.
That's it. Skimmers on the machines at the pumps. So this is a real, real simple way to keep track of your charges. And it's a simple thing,
mm-hmm.
But if you do it every single time you fill up, it makes a huge difference at the end of the month when you're trying to tally all that stuff together, or at least keep track of all that stuff.
Don't get skimmed. Don't get scammed.
I know. It has no place in this podcast.
It kind of does, in that we're talking about, well, I'll say it, although it may be controversial, we're talking about one of the oldest scams in the book of history.
Yeah, and you know a little bit about this to begin with, because you have another podcast, as many people will know, The Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. And years ago, you did a podcast and a video series, maybe even. I don't know if there's more than one, but at least one or two videos on cults.
Yes, that is right. Scott, you also made an appearance in the video, and thank you so much for doing so.
That's right.
Wherein one of my co-hosts and I started a cult, or attempted to start a cult. And what we were doing really was, hopefully in a humorous way, presenting the mechanics of how a cult works, what people do as leaders of cults, as followers of cults, to grow a cult, and why so often these things meet with a bad end for the majority of people involved.
Yeah.
But you may be asking yourself, Scott, Ben, Noel the Movement Brown, why are you guys talking about cults today?
Yeah, this isn't a show about religion.
This isn't cult stuff.
This is car stuff. So what's going on? And if you read the title, you probably know where we're headed with this. But you're going to find that there's another couple. You know what? I'm going to slip another couple of automotive manufacturers into this podcast that maybe you don't know about. It's semi-related.
Great.
In a way. So when we get to it, you'll hear what I'm talking about. But don't tune out if you think that there's going to be a lot about this guy, this religion, this movement, and it's fascinating stuff. It's really interesting. We'll give you some interesting things to look at and listen to along the way,
and some specs as well.
And some specs, that's right. Yeah, and just fascinating stuff. This is a really intriguing story, and I encourage listeners to dig into this even further if they would like to, because. Well, it comes from one of the books that we regularly refer to here on the show, right?
Right, yes. One of our favorite car stuff texts, Strange But True, Tales of Car Collecting, by a fellow named Keith Martin, along with the editors of Sports Car Market. Our story begins on December 11th, 1931, when a strapping young man named Chandra Mohan Jain is born.
A strapping young man. That's how you're going to
describe it. A strapping infant.
That's all right. No problem.
We'll leave. A kid in good health.
All right. Well, this guy, I don't know what he was like in his early youth. I'm sure he was strapping, Ben. But no, I shouldn't rail him.
I'm not sure what strapping means, actually. I've been reading a lot of older books. Does it mean in shape?
It does, I think.
It totally doesn't fit.
Well, it's okay. Well, it's fine as is.
A regular person.
A normal boy was born in India, and then later in life, he went on to get a master's degree in philosophy. He was a professor at an Indian university in the 1950s and 1960s, and somehow he became this kind of this self-described spiritual leader along the way.
Yes, yeah, a chosen one, someone with the express HOV lane access to divinity.
And he was a disciple of a Russian spiritual teacher, who thought his belief, I guess, was that most humans live in what they call a walking sleep or awake. Right. I'm sorry, a waking sleep.
A waking sleep, and that they live and die in this condition in some sort of benighted existence without enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. And so this guy, we'll just call him Sri Rajneesh. Mm-hmm. Should we give him the title right now, Ben, or not?
You know, let's go ahead and do it.
All right, the Bhagwan.
Yes.
Bhagwan, which means, it's Sanskrit for, like the chosen one, the embodiment of God. Mm-hmm. So this is like the human form of God on earth, and he is here to deliver the message of God to his followers. And, so the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, formed his own cult. I shouldn't say cult. His own movement.
Right.
In 1974 in India.
Mm-hmm. And this was set up at a place called Pune, P-O-O-N-A. And along the way, the Bhagwan was making some major waves. He was an advocate of free love. He was doing some of the things that are considered by researchers to be indicative of a cult.
Yeah.
So right away, before we go any further, I know that term is troubling to some people.
It's a loaded term.
It's a loaded term, and it may be an unfair one as well. One person's cult is another person's true religion, right? So the connotations of a cult are things like removing the agency or autonomy of the followers, removing their financial independence, things like that. And as we'll see, regardless of how this came to be or the intentions behind it, ultimately that is what happened to a lot of these people.
Yeah, he was referring to himself as a mystic, a guru, a leader, you know, a spiritual leader, a spiritual teacher.
A messianic figure, yeah.
Exactly. And he created, I guess, what they call the Rajneesh movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the movement was, and of course, this following of people that would follow him and do whatever he said and whatever he thought. And it was really just textbook, I keep referring back to it, but it's textbook cult
right.
behavior. And he, along the way, of course, you know, he's profiting from, Westerners and Europeans that are visiting, this Indian, complex that he is set up now at this point. And it's kind of like a retreat, but he is using the money from that retreat to, enhance his lifestyle, I guess, Ben. He was a lover of the finer things in life. So even though he was preaching and practicing, or not really practicing, he's preaching that, austerity and, service and service community and things like that, to his followers. He was, partaking of the finest French brandy and chocolates and Chinese jade and,
handmade watches.
Yeah. Pens. He was big into pens, which I found strange. Not fountain pens, but like the, regular pens, like stick pens.
Mm-hmm.
However, he would get, like the gold and silver pens that were diamond encrusted. And at the top of the line, he would order pen after pen from companies that would create these luxurious pens. I don't know how better to describe a pen, but not luxurious really, but it's a luxury item.
And in 1981, the problems between his organization and the government of India, the Indian authorities, inspired a move to the United States.
Yeah. Ben, I need to mention one quick thing here. Mm. When he was in India, he was driving Mercedes-Benz and some other top-of-the-line cars, but not quite to the level that we're going to talk about in just a moment.
That's right, Scott. Yeah, this guy has a love for the finer things. He and his second-in-command had discussed the idea of establishing a new commune in the later in the year of 1980, so he didn't agree to travel there until May of 1981. When he got there, he established a compound where they bought around, 100 square miles or so?
Well, it's 64,000 square acres.
Okay, yeah. Or 260 square kilometers, this ranch, which had been called the Big Muddy Ranch, located across two counties and near a small town in Oregon named Antelope.
Yeah, and Ben, I'm going to just jump right ahead and tell you this, that they quickly renamed that ranch. It was no longer the Big Muddy Ranch. It became Rajneeshpuram, or the, was it Rancho Rajneesh?
Yeah.
Some called it. A lot of different names for it. But as they moved into this town, or this area, the closest local area was a town called Antelope, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And did we even say that? They're in Oregon?
Yeah.
Okay, so they're
surprise.
So they're in Oregon, like the northern part of the state in this this community that has, at this point in 1981, the population of nearby Antelope was 47 people. So very, very small area. It was a ranching town. They were really tolerant at first of this big group moving in because he brought with him about 1,200 people, I think, a huge group of people, and they were going to inhabit this ranch, but they found that the ranch did not have all the facilities that they needed, all the
running water,
utilities. Yeah,
utilities,
not facilities.
Because
they were building facilities, but they didn't have utilities. That was the problem. They didn't have electricity and running water and everything necessary. They didn't have roads or any of that stuff. So all that was going to be constructed and built on this property. But so as you can guess, Ben, it wasn't too long before they kind of moved into the downtown area of Antelope, the small downtown area. And they started buying up property. They started renaming things, as I said. And they were changing the names of things. So they quickly also took political positions in town.
Right.
Which is important, really important. And, as I said, the people in Antelope were at first tolerant, but then they became a little bit concerned, and then eventually they became angry with this group, and we'll find out why. But as I said, they were changing names. It's like they changed things into like places called like Zorba the Buddha Nightclub and Zorba the Zorba Deli, or you know, places like things like that. They changed the name of the landfill, Ben, to, this is the strangest thing,
all right,
the Adolf Hitler Recycling Center.
I don't
have any clue why they did that. It almost seems like just a like a snubbing to the people of the town. Like, we're just going to name
very
things
strange
in an outrageous way.
Well, maybe there was some sort of spiritual logic behind it.
No, there probably wasn't.
It was just vindictive.
Just a mean move, I think. Just to change, just to show how dramatically they were going to change things in this small town. And you know, should we mention that at this point he decided that, you know, after the purchase of the property, which was for something like $6 million, that ranch wasn't cheap.
Yeah,
$6 million. He began a period of public silence. He wasn't going to speak anymore. So he had a sidekick. And the sidekick was someone named Ma Aman Sheila.
Ah, yes. The, a very outspoken, passionate, person who became the gatekeeper for any communication with the leader of this movement.
Yeah, because he was not speaking to anybody. He wasn't doing any interviews, wasn't doing any of that. This was the mouthpiece for the organization. And it was kind of up to her, I guess, in the direction that all this went. You know, the way that the media saw this group moving into this small town in Oregon.
Which is going to be instrumental later in the ultimate evolution of this situation.
I just did it. I said Oregon. I meant to say Oregon. I'm from the Midwest, so I say it sometimes both ways. You'll hear it both ways in this podcast.
It's funny because we talked off the air about it, and one of our coworkers is from Oregon, and you had assured me, you said, well, he's from Oregon, and I asked him, and he says this is the correct way to pronounce it, but yeah. I might go back and forth.
Yeah, yeah. I have the different pronunciation. I think there's a couple of different ways to say it, but anybody from that region will say Oregon. So I'll try to stick to that as we go through here. But this person, the Sheila, we'll just call her Sheila.
Sheila.
Yeah, Ma Non Sheila. She was what they called, they said that she was acid-tongued, pistol-packing. She was his right-hand man, really, but it was a female.
Yeah, and
but,
you can see some hilariously awkward interviews with her.
Oh, yeah, you know what? Can I point them to one?
Yes.
Okay, so if you want to just get a taste of what this person is like, just Google search for this. Good luck to you and your pimps. Search for that, and you'll find a 3-minute video clip that will encapsulate what this person is like in a lot of interviews. It's not just that one.
Right.
The further you dig deeper, you'll find that most interviews went this way with her.
Yes, very contentious. The interview that Scott is referencing in particular was in Perth, Australia.
Yeah. So here's the thing: we're going to get to the Rolls Royces, I promise, because it's coming fast here. This group grows quickly. I mean, of course, he has a huge following from India. There were something like 50,000 visitors annually to this place in India when he left. And of course, he left amid some turmoil there. It wasn't on his own terms by any means. Right. But when he gets here, it also quickly grows into the thousands of people that are visiting. And of course, they're all, you know, contributing, to the commune, and the dollars in the bank account begin to grow and grow and grow. And pretty soon, this group has something like 5,000 people that live on the commune. Now remember, this is a town of formerly of 47 people.
Right, right.
Now there's 5,000 people living on this commune and $100 million in the bank.
Including infrastructure. So they went from no water, no phone lines, no gas, no sewage, to a community with a fire department, police, restaurants, malls, an airstrip, a bus system, a sewage reclamation plant.
It's a shocking growth for this community. And not only that, it's really strange because they call this group the Orange People. And the Orange People name is maybe a little bit outdated at this point, because here in the States, they changed their mode of dress, I guess, just a little bit. They want it to be the warm colors of the sunrise, I think, is what they described it as. So these followers would all wear initially just orange robes, and that was where the Orange People name came from.
Mm-hmm.
Now they were able to wear reds, maroons, pinks, any color that you would find in the morning sunrise. And that was what they were described as. And they were all dressed in that way. And you would see them in large groups out, you know, out and about the city. Oh, by the way, In public parks, they ruled that nudity would be allowed as well. So
it was just
part of this whole free love idea. And just, I guess, I'm not really giving anything away here. This was oftentimes seen as a sex cult,
right?
Because of the Enlightenment thing.
And Rajneesh's idea on that was that the human mind or individuals in current society were too hung up on the concept of sex, and that this repression was in the way was stymieing progress spiritually. So that his argument would be, I'm making it not a big deal.
Yes, sex is enlightenment to him and his followers, and not only that, drugs as well, and that those play into this whole thing as well. So, let's just go ahead and say it right now. What he was also a nitrous oxide user.
Yes, he had a $12,000 commercial grade dentist chair, and he would just go through laughing gas.
Yeah, a huge amount of laughing gas.
Huge amounts.
He was regularly hooked up to this thing, I guess, in this really expensive chair, and that was like how he would free his mind, I guess, and mm-hmm. come up with these teachings. And he would give lectures. There's many, many clips of him, sitting in a chair lecturing to a large group about many different subjects that you would not think that a spiritual leader would be discussing. And most of them revolve around love, sex, relationships, drugs.
Yeah.
There's an infamous one about the F word.
The most powerful word in the world.
Yeah, he calls it the most powerful. And it's almost, if you look at it now, it's almost like a comedy routine.
It's like performance art.
It's really bizarre. Very, very strange behavior, but an interesting character, no doubt.
And
this guy, with his $100 million and more coming in all the time, it was like they just didn't have anywhere to spend it. I mean, it's coming in that fast. So he develops, like we said, a habit for the finer things, and one of those habits that he decided to grow into, I guess, would be purchasing fine European automobiles in the form of the Rolls Royce.
Yes, it is true. During the height of his Rolls Royce collecting career, and we will show you his side of the story as well, folks. During the height of Rajneesh's Rolls Royce collection, he had a little under 100 Rolls Royces. This collection, by the way, was not considered complete because, you see, his followers, at least according to the official party line, wanted to ultimately have 365 so that he could drive one every day of the year. The reason this became so iconic in U.S. history was that there would be, well, even before a lot of the criminal activity that led to the downfall of this particular location, even before that, it became iconic because there was such a visual contrast between these people toiling in fields and building infrastructure and then lining up at 2 p.m. it was, I believe,
every day, 2 p.m.
Every day at 2 p.m. to throw flowers on this guy's Rolls Royce, one of them, as he drove past.
Yeah, as he delivered a drive-by blessing.
Yes.
A daily drive-by blessing. Now, the thing that you're saying that the optics of this were really, really poor.
Right. It looked like massive inequality.
Yeah, because these people are working literally 7 days a week in jobs that are in service to Rajneesh so that this commune can continue. Whether it's in goods and products that they can sell to, locals or the rest of the commune.
Right.
And as well as, other people from outside that come into the Antelope area. But the thing is, like, the commune itself had 41 businesses and they were all staffed by like 1,500 people that worshiped they called it worshiping at the jobs.
Uh-huh.
And for that, in exchange, they would get $10 each month. And this is 1980. 1981, I think it was 1981. They would get $10 a month, free vegetarian meals, and a mattress space in an A-frame house. So very austere living conditions, mm-hmm. very, very minimal. And here he is driving by in one of his 93, Rolls Royces for the daily drive-by blessing as they're standing at the road, praying to him. It's a really difficult image to take in, I guess, if you see what's happened, like the disparity between the two there.
Right.
Not only that, he's making money from there were other commune residents that didn't work in those businesses, but that would pay pay to live there, to experience life with him on a daily basis.
And then with him for a drive-by at 2 p.m.
Yeah, and then there were others that were like, you know, the farmers and the, you know, the other community members that would work in places like the Rajneesh Deli or the Rajneesh Beauty Salon or the Rajneesh Bookstore. And the bookstore only carried Rajneesh's books. So he had he had 650 books that he had written, or supposedly he had written.
Which I'm skeptical about.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So he had written 650 books, let's say. And those are on the shelves, and that's all you can buy in there. And he would sell photos of himself. And every follower had a photo of him on, you know, a wooden beaded necklace that they
would
wear around their neck.
Which they did not get for free.
No, they had to pay for that as well. So it's really interesting, but they would work 7 days a week at this, and then he'd do these drive-by Rolls-Royce blessings. And this was, I think he got his first Rolls-Royce in 1980. So before the actual, you know, commune was anything, you know, but when he first arrived in the United States, he bought one. And then after that point, you know, he decided that that was the car for him. That was going to be the way that he traveled. And I think he passed it off. Didn't he say something like it was like the serenity that he
experienced?
Yeah, something about driving in it. It was so perfectly quiet and serene that it was the way that he needed to travel in order to be able to meditate, I think was how he put it. Something along that lines. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But in 1980, he had the first one. And later, you know, as his as this started to grow, you know, the commune started to pick up strength of in numbers and in dollars. This became something that he would do twice a month. He would purchase a new Rolls Royce twice a month.
Right, and he defended this by he had called himself the rich man's guru before, and he said once, "I would like the whole world to live so luxuriously that people start becoming bored with luxury, and the whole earth is capable for the first time to be so luxurious that you don't feel any material need. All material needs are fulfilled. Then what are you going to do? There is nothing else than meditation." So in this perspective, and I do feel like in interest of fairness, we have to present his side of it. In his perspective, this was a step toward enabling the world to gain greater enlightenment. So the logic from the detractor's side would be like, oh, so it's okay for you to have all these people. He also maintains that his followers bought the Rolls Royces for the commune.
Yeah.
And that he didn't own them. But the logic there to the opponents of this idea would be, it doesn't make it for everyone if you just say, this is for everyone.
You know, Ben, I did read an article in a magazine that's called 1859 Oregon. And the article was talking about, you know, the invasion, I guess. They called it an invasion.
Yeah.
And the person that wrote this, her father, I think, was a city council member or something like that. I'm foggy on the details of that because I wasn't really focused on that at the moment. But the author mentioned, as a child, remembering seeing commune members driving in those Rolls Royces. So they might have had use of those on occasion.
Right.
Or maybe with some of the higher up members of the church.
Or the VIP visitors.
Of the movement, I should
say.
Yeah, so maybe that was it. But they do remember seeing someone other than Rajneesh driving those Rolls Royces into town. However, you don't have to have that as kind of like the fleet vehicle for your commune. I mean, that's a pretty extravagant thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all know that what's going on here. It was for him. It's for him. They're all decorated the way that he wanted them to be decorated. Because that's another thing we haven't even touched on.
Oh, gosh.
Is that these aren't just like from the factory versions of Rolls-Royce cars. He would paint them in psychedelic colors. He would use, you know, lace curtains to further decorate them. Just crazy, bizarre paint jobs that were created by his Swami artists.
And these were new Rolls Royces. We should emphasize that. These weren't, you know, vintage Phantoms or anything.
No, in early 80s, I think they said that the price of Rolls Royce cars was somewhere in between, it was like $110,000 to about $165,000 for the top end.
Yeah, there was a time where, there was a brief period of time there where they were the most expensive production car in the world.
Yeah, and that would have been right then, probably.
Right.
And I mean, so, in 1980, $165,000. I don't have my calculator in front of me here, but that's a lot of money. So, yeah, they weren't cheap by any means, and I think they went up to even higher than that. They were like $175,000 at the top end, I think. But he was generating a huge amount of sales to the, not just to that area, to one person, but to the United States, because Rolls-Royce wasn't producing as many cars as they do now.
Oh, I've got the calculation there, Scott.
Oh, okay, you do.
$165,000 in, let's say, 1980, when he bought the first one.
Sure.
Would be, roughly $476,841.99.
So this is, ballpark. I mean, if we put it in today's perspective, this is $1 million a month habit.
Yeah.
$1 million a month. Oh, you know what? One more quick thing, a little side note. I forgot to mention this. He was also enamored with movies of all kinds.
Mm.
And he would watch movies, I would guess, while he's on, you know, his nitrous meditation, you know, kick. I would think he'd watch movies all day long because he was watching so many to the point where he had staff members or members of the commune that would fly to nearby cities like San Francisco or maybe to Portland and buy the latest movies to stock his shelves. He had that many movies and that much of a fixation on watching the latest movies. And he would just do that all day long while he was thinking or whatever he was doing.
And it seems more and more isolated, too, which is where our story takes a little bit of a turn. But first, let's talk about maybe the kind of Rolls-Royces that he had. So we mentioned that a lot of these had paint jobs, which some of your more traditional members of car stuff may find disturbing. One great example would be the black kimono Rolls-Royce, which you can see some close-up pictures of on YouTube. This is a silver spur. A silver spur Rolls-Royce is the longer wheelbase version of the Silver Spirit. And these are nice cars. This is the first time in Rolls-Royce history that they have the retractable
Spirit of Ecstasy.
Yeah, the retractable Spirit of Ecstasy, because as you may know from one of our earlier shows, that is also one of the most frequently stolen, stolen badges of his
show. Oh, no kidding. So it was automated even back then. Mm-hmm. All right. So this is one that's, it's painted. Now, just this one in particular, this is one of 93, by the way.
Yeah, the black kimono.
The black kimono. Is this the one that has swans painted on the outside, flying swans? And I believe any of the kimono versions of these, if you see the word kimono after or anywhere in the name, he also would wear matching kimonos that went along with this for photo opportunities.
Right.
Because there was a lot of press out there interested in talking to him or at least talking to his followers while he was standing there.
Mm-hmm.
So these elaborate photo shoots would happen with him dressed to match this Rolls Royce. It's just it's unbelievable what was going on there. And there's so many of those, too. I mean, there's several themed Rolls Royce cars.
Yeah,
that he had in the collection. It was, you know, I think every one of them had some kind of crazy paint job. It wasn't like there were many that were left stock.
Right, like swans, Japanese silk robes, super bright candy colors on them, two-tone vehicles. Yeah, almost every paint job on these was custom.
And for the most part, he dealt with one local dealer, I think, and had a good reputation and relationship with that guy. The owners of the owners of Rolls-Royce at the time, the CEOs, the top guns there would say, it's an unusual place, but he's a great customer. We really enjoy selling our product to him. There's a good, marketing opportunity there for us, because anybody who has 93 of our cars, of course, that's going to be a great customer. And, just to give you an idea of what's going on here, Rolls-Royce Motor Cars, I think the U.S. headquarters at the time was in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. I don't know if that's still true or not, but they said it was a profitable and somewhat odd relationship with Rajneesh. Of course, with what he's asking for, the colors and things,
right,
the combinations.
Yeah.
The commune had its own service center, and a Rolls-Royce engineer would periodically travel there to troubleshoot the cars for him because he did drive them. And that's another thing, a little spinoff here, too, is that a lot of people felt that he was kind of a menace on the roads in that area. They didn't like him because he would drive these, I guess, really fast and kind of recklessly
Remember,
on the back roads.
These have V8 engines, too.
Yeah, so. rear-wheel drive V8. Yeah. I'm guessing he's doing a little bit of
his gun in it.
Yeah, he's doing a little bit of Bhagwan drifting out there in the rural areas of Oregon. So a lot of people didn't like the way he drove those cars around. And I don't know how much there is to that. Of course, they probably just didn't like the guy in general because what he's doing to the place.
But the company only made 2,500 of the car of those cars per year.
Every year, and then not that many made it to America. Only 1,100 made it to America. So he's buying a percentage, a pretty good chunk of the cars that are coming to America. just himself. He represented something like, I think it was over $1.5 million in sales, I think, in 1985, for this one guy. And of course, that was towards the end, I guess, in 1985. Mm-hmm. That was the near the end of the whole thing. But what an interesting character this was. Now, there are some things that led to the downfall of this cult in this town. Now, so he's, of course, amassed this huge collection. There's, all these strange happenings going around. He's renamed everything in town. They've got political control of that Antelope area.
Right. They're bringing things to a boiling point, to what Malcolm Gladwell would call a tipping point, when they do things like, politically shut down the native residences' access to schools of their choice. And then he is also going, according to his former right hand, Sheila, he's also, going bigger, and he demands, at a time when he has 90 Rolls Royces, that she buy 30 more.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So, so it's getting a little bit crazy. They're really, hungry for political seats at this point.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get seats on the county board. There's only 3 seats, I guess, on this county board. 2 of them are up for grabs in this election that's coming up at the end of 1984. And this gets really strange. And I don't know how much we really even want to go into this, but, they launched one of only 2 bioterror attacks that happened in the United States, foisted against, U.S. citizens.
Right. Yes. In a town called The Dalles, Oregon, a faction of the movement coordinated and successfully deployed Salmonella in a deliberate food poisoning attack. And they were doing this specifically to influence the outcome of that election you just mentioned.
This is so crazy. They poisoned the entire town in order to keep them from going to the polls so that they would then have the majority vote, so they could get those county seats.
And that was in 1984.
1984. And you can look up the details of this whole thing, but it was 10 local restaurants, and they distributed it via glasses of water, salad bars, salsa,
yeah.
Salsa bars,
salad dressings.
Yes, yeah, salad. Yeah. That was what I was thinking. Salad dressings, and, just any way that, they would go to buffet restaurants and distribute it there, in the salads. So that a lot of people got this. And in the end, 751 people contracted this, it was Salmonella is what they distributed, the biological agent. Mm-hmm. And 45 had to be hospitalized. There were no fatalities, luckily, but there were some that were very close to dying from this. It was a really serious attack. In fact, it was probably the largest attack. The other one that we're talking about would be
2001 anthrax.
Yes. Yes. 2001 yeah. where anthrax was sent to, media agencies.
This, what's interesting, the people here who were accused were very fortunate that no one died. 2 of the leading officials were convicted on charges of attempted murder. They served 29 months of 20-year sentences. They were at a minimum security federal pen. But what did, this may be of interest, what did our Rolls-Royce-loving leader of the movement say when he found out about this?
Ah, he blamed it on everybody else. He was not involved at all, right? There was nothing wrong here, nothing to see. It was other members. I have no control over what they're doing, right?
He also said that there were other crimes that he had found out they were planning to assassinate a U.S. attorney. He asked state and federal authorities to investigate whether or not he is telling the truth in that situation. That's what people refer to as getting out in front of something.
Ben, see, I'm chuckling at this because what they thought was a peace-loving, nonviolent commune, on the surface, I guess. And I think the locals knew better than this because they saw the actual activity, what was happening. But the front that was put out there for the media, for the public, was that they're a peaceful, nonviolent group. But it turns out that they're involved in arson, murder plots, of course, the bioterrorism, with the poisoning, prostitution, wiretapping.
Drug running.
Yeah, drug running. There was illegal immigration fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Just unbelievable amount of things that were going on. And the people that were charged for the poisoning were also fined $500,000. But as you said, they were put in a minimum security prison and released after just a few months, really, only like 20 months or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or 29, you said, out of a 20-year sentence. And that's for attempted murder. I don't know what the reasoning was behind that, but they got out, and one of them was Sheila.
Yes.
One of them, and I think there was another female that was...
Diane Von Onang.
Yeah, who I think went by Ma Anand Sunshine, maybe.
Yeah, that was her Ma Anand Pooja.
Yeah, okay, well.
Yeah, yeah.
The names are confusing, but mm-hmm. Those two were put away for this, and he just ratted him out. I mean, and then after all that, you know, when he got out in front of the charges, as you said, he hightailed it out of the country. Back to India and started up another commune.
And changed his title to Osha.
Yeah.
Or Osho, excuse me.
One thing.
Yeah,
though,
yeah.
With eight Rolls Royces in tow.
Yes.
Because he had set up of course he knew that all this is going down, you know, that mm-hmm. he was likely not going to be able to hang on to everything. So, you know, as they find all the fancy pens and his $12,000 dentist chair and, you know, everything that, was going on behind the scenes at the commune, he realized that he wasn't going to be able to take the 93 Rolls Royces with him. So he puts eight of them into, a separate trust for him. So he
right.
owns those outright. And because he's not part of this whole thing, you know, he was, I guess if you can call it on the good side, he's on the good side of this trial. Good side, I mean that he didn't serve any prison time.
Right. And that he was the one who officially sent out an official request for an investigation. Now, another part of his side of the story is that in 1981, he gave Sheila, his lieutenant, limited power of attorney. Mm-hmm. And in 1982, he removed limits on that. So Sheila announced in 83 that he would only speak with her. And later he says, so it's very plausible, right? That's plausible deniability, Scott, because later he says, she didn't tell me any of this. I would never condone poisoning people
okay.
to rig an election.
Well, the whole commune was wired for video and audio.
Right.
Surveillance. The payphones were all tapped that were on the property. They found that there was a wiretapping control room of sorts that was behind a secret door in Sheila's room of this commune. He knew what was going on. He knew all this was happening.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, of course. And he was involved, he was involved in this stuff in India before he even came over to the United States as well. So it doesn't seem too hard to believe that he would be involved in this here as well.
So you're saying there's a precedent?
Yeah. I think there's a precedent for this there. And again, that's all kind of the fallout of this whole thing. But the other part of this was that now that they had to kind of break up what was remaining there, you know, now the town of Antelope was returned to Antelope. And by the way, they've got a plaque in town
mm-hmm.
where they refer to this as the invasion. And you can read what it says. There's an inscribed plaque that, I can read it to you. I've got what it says.
Yeah.
It's right outside of the Antelope, Oregon post office, and it commemorates the local resistance to the time, you know, I guess designated the time between 1981 and 1985. It says, dedicated to those of this community who throughout the Rajneesh invasion and occupation of 1981 to 1985 remained, resisted, and remembered. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And that is a quote by Edmund Burke, who was an 18th century Irish statesman. So they called it an invasion and an occupation between 1981 and 1985. I mean, it goes to show you how they felt about this group moving into their community and just taking over. And,
yeah.
you know, there was a lot of media surrounding this. I mean, I remember in 1985, as this was all falling apart, watching this on, I think it was 60 Minutes maybe. And if it wasn't the U.S. version, it was the Australian version of 60 Minutes that they were then replaying here in the States, because I do remember seeing the people in all their different robe colors
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the Rolls Royces driving by, but I didn't know the whole story. I don't think I really paid much attention at the time.
Now, the Bhagwan entered a guilty plea.
Really?
Yeah. So the way he did it is, this is the kind of plea where someone does not admit guilt, but does contest the charges. He was contesting charges that he had concealed his intent to stay in the country indefinitely.
So he can what, plead guilty with no time served or anything or something like that? Or no,
right.
No time to be served.
He received a suspended sentence, 5 years probation, and a $400,000 penalty.
Well, then after that 5 month probation is when he lit out of here then, probably.
He hightailed it. And I know what a lot of us are thinking. This was one of my first questions too. What happened to the rest of those cars?
Yeah, what happened to the other 85, right? So,
right.
I guess the best way to say this is that, you know, Rolls-Royce decided that they wanted to make sure that, these were indeed, cars that were befitting the Rolls-Royce name before they were put up for auction. Because auction was the primary focus here. They were going to just get rid of the whole lot of them all at one time.
And they were also, you can tell from some of their publications and later statements and interviews, that they were increasingly uncomfortable with being associated with this movement, for good or ill. But there's a great quotation wherein one Rolls-Royce veteran is describing how horrified the Rolls-Royce execs were when they saw what was happening in these vehicles, you know, like something that has a kitchen window lace pasted on the windows.
Exactly. And or cotton balls glued to the outside of it. Uh-huh. Stuff like that was happening. And of course, you know, the crazy paint schemes and everything that were concocted or dreamed up. But Rolls-Royce did inspect the cars. This is kind of an unusual move on their part.
Yeah.
Just to give you a heads up here, two of these offers that I'm going to tell you about failed. The third one was accepted, but Rolls-Royce inspected the cars and then, in a surprising move, offered to buy all of them.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why that happened, but the offer, I guess, was, you know, far short of what the commune thought they were worth. The commune thought they were worth $5 million mm-hmm. as a collection. So these 85 vehicles, $5 million, they thought it was way too much. The company thought that was too much.
Yeah.
So that says something right there. I don't know what their offer was, but then a group called Consolidated International, which this is where the other two car manufacturers come in that I mentioned earlier on in the podcast.
Yeah. Tell me about this.
This is strange. Now, Consolidated International, which is now known as the Big Lot chain of stores. So, you know, Big Lots that you see, you know, the retail stores.
No way.
You know, they buy all the stuff. It's like leftovers from stores that they sell. Big Lots, you would think, what do they have an interest in 85 Rolls-Royces? Why are they doing that? It's really just a big company that buys and sells things to other investors. So, you know, they'll buy like construction equipment, they'll buy auto parts or, you know, consumer closeout products. And this was something that interested them at the time. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Why would they dabble in Rolls-Royce? You know, because it's kind of out of their realm.
Oh, by the way, 5 million in 85 is the equivalent of about 11.2 million today.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's a huge chunk of money for 85 Rolls-Royces, but, and in this condition, because we do know that Rolls-Royce offered them a significantly less amount because they wouldn't accept it. All right. So I was thinking, why would Consolidated International, you know, Big Lots, be interested in these Rolls-Royces? But apparently they were the company that acquired the DeLorean assets back in 1983.
Oh, man, so they're making moves.
So when, you know, remember when DeLorean shut down amid the scandal, you know, mm-hmm. in Ireland,
mm-hmm.
all of the unbuilt cars and parts and machinery and all that was left behind, that's the group that purchased all of that. You know, and I thought, well, that's really interesting. They were the owners of DeLorean for a while. Then I found out that they also purchased the Bricklin Car Company. You know, from Malcolm Bricklin, when he built his SV1, the sports car, and I think that, I want to say the early 1980s, I think was when that happened. But interesting that, you know, they're involved in all this. So that's so DeLorean has a mention here, and so does Bricklin. The third person to come in, they felt the $5 million price tag was too much as well. So they didn't bite.
Mm-hmm.
They offered them less. They didn't accept it, of course. And then the third bid, was a guy named Bob Roethlisberger, who was the co-owner of a place called European Auto Group in Dallas. And Roethlisberger arrived at the commune just 3 days before Thanksgiving Day in 1985. So this is the, you know, November of 1985. He was in a private jet and he had a $6 million line of credit from his bank and a $2 million cash down payment to make. So, of course, money talks. Ooh. And he was able to pick up the entire lot of vehicles, all 85. And according to this article in the Orlando Sentinel, he paid almost $7 million in the end for all 85 vehicles. So, you know, that's less the eight that Rajneesh took mm-hmm. off with as well. So here he is in November. He's got to get 85 vehicles back to Texas. And he shows up with more than a dozen, or maybe it's a dozen car haulers that have to go through deep snow and trying to load 85 Rolls-Royces onto these car haulers in November. It's a difficult thing to do, and it cost him a pile of money, too. It cost him $200,000 just to haul them down to Texas.
So this is already seeming like a more complicated idea than you would have wanted.
I would say so. And, Ben, it takes a tragic turn here because the guy, the Roethlisberger guy that I just mentioned, He was only 40 years old, and in April of 1986, the very next year, just, 6 months later, he died of cancer, at the age of 40. And at that time, at that moment, 43 of those cars had already been sold somewhere between $65,000 and $100,000 each. And so that leaves, 42 cars left to go. And 30 of those cars went to an unidentified buyer from somewhere in the Middle East. I don't know if they've ever identified who that was. It's probably known at this point, but not in this article. And a lot of those cars that were then remaining from that, you know, the 30 as well as, you know, the remaining 12 that stayed in Texas, some of them were repainted, but they found that a lot of the people that were interested in these cars, you know, like filmmakers and athletes and business owners, they wanted those crazy colors. They wanted the psychedelic paint jobs. They wanted the unusual rainbow car and the kimono cars and the autumn car. They all had theme names. So
yeah,
they were all interested in those. And you can see photos of, I think it might be Roethlisberger outside of that European motor car company, you know, with hands in the air, you know, celebrating the fact that he's got this lot full of Rolls-Royce cars. Mm-hmm. Really interesting time in history. Strange story. There's so much to say about this story. We're just barely touching the tip of the iceberg on the interesting stuff that's going on behind the scenes at this commune.
Yeah, and this movement, we must say, this movement continues after the death of its founder. So
yeah, which happened not long after as well, right?
Right, in January of 1990, at the age of 58, yeah. Osho, aka Chandra Mohan Jain, aka Rajneesh, passed away. And often in spiritual movements of this nature, they die within either the founder's generation or the generation of their successor, and typically their successor is some kid that they raised in this movement. So it does speak to at least the commitment of the followers that it continues. However, their national or international renown really peaked in the 80s, and Rolls-Royce spokespeople for Rolls-Royce will downplay their involvement in this incident by saying, you know, this is a blip in our 8 decades and counting history.
Oh, I agree, but it was also at the time for several years. I mean, it was a something that a lot of people really focused on. It got a lot of press that that he was the Rolls-Royce cult leader.
The Rolls-Royce guru.
Yeah, the Rolls-Royce guru. Maybe that's a better way to put it. But, yeah, it kind of worked for them for a while, you know. They used that to their advantage, I think. Of course they did. You know,
sure.
As they said, he's a good customer. You know, we're not going to destroy that relationship because of, you know, the way that this appears to everybody. But, yeah, you're right. As a company as a whole, I guess maybe, it was a minor blip on the screen, in the history of the company now.
May I read a quote from the man himself, the Bhagwan himself?
Sure.
Okay. It's a little bit long. You okay with that?
Oh, sure. Why not? All right. It's always entertaining.
Just the other day, Anando was showing me one book published against me in Australia by a couple who have been sannyasins for 3 years and have been in the commune. But just looking at their ideas, it seems they have never seen me. They are saying that they were working hard, and with their work I was purchasing Rolls-Royces. You can see the absurdity. Their work was not bringing any money. Their work was making their own houses to live in, the roads, which were needing money, not producing money. But in their mind, and for all those 3 years also, they must have been resentful. Those Rolls-Royces were not produced by the commune. They were presents from outside, from all over the world, and I was not their owner. I had given them to the commune. They were commune property, and I have not brought any of them with me. I have left them with the commune. Side note, not entirely true. Anyway, he continues, everything that I had has been left with the commune. I never owned anything, but there must have been the idea that they are earning money and I am wasting money. That is their resentment. What money were you earning? In fact, you needed money to make houses, to make roads, to make a dam. A dam needed $2.5 million to make. You were contributing your labor, but we were not creating money out of it so that I could purchase Rolls-Royces, so that I could purchase anything. I have not purchased anything from the money produced by the commune because the commune never produced any money. The commune was absorbing money. In fact, all my royalties, all my books, all their profits were going to the commune. The situation is just the opposite, that I had given everything to the commune. Now, 400 books in different languages were bringing millions of dollars in royalties. Those royalties were going to the commune. If I had wanted to purchase Rolls-Royces, I could have purchased my own Rolls-Royces, as many as I wanted, just out of my royalties.
Okay. Well, the flaw in the thinking about the labor there, because he's saying that they're a bit resentful that they work 7 days a week all day long, and this guy will drive by in his Rolls-Royce to give them a drive-by blessing at 2 p.m., and that's
right.
That's all they get. You know, or outside of $10 a month, and what was it, a free space on a mattress, I think, and free vegetarian meals, I think that was the other thing. The problem is that they're building up this community that is then sought out by, you know, Americans and Europeans that come here to, I think he said they spend something, again, we're talking tens of thousands of people visiting every year.
Yeah.
I mean, 50,000 plus, maybe even more than that. And he said they spend an average of something like $500 a piece every week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unbelievable the amount of money that's coming in, but he's not distributing that to the people that are really putting in the work, the backbreaking work in order to keep that going. He's not paying a fair wage.
Right. And he also these were not all silver spurs. They had spirits. They had, you know, whatever they get their hands on.
So some lower line Rolls Royces,
right.
Is what you're saying.
They leased several of these.
You know, can I just make a quick
clarification? Yeah,
when I say it wasn't paying fair, and I understand that some people are going to say, well, what they were getting in return was spiritual enlightenment. And they were, you know, they were part of this. They went into this knowing what they were getting.
Mm-hmm.
And they had agreed to give up all of their material things in order to be part of the spiritual movement, and that's what they were getting out of it.
And they also, and then there's also that argument that maybe this was a security concern. The guy didn't leave the compound without a bodyguard or a driver. You know, several of the vehicles had some customized protective things, like there's one that had tear gas nozzles in the bumper.
Oh, no kidding.
There's one. Yeah, there was one that was extended and armored, 1979 Silver Wraith II.
That was his first Rolls Royce. He had it plated with armor after he purchased it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then also, bulletproofing, special air conditioning, and, you know, filtration, and then custom carpeting and stuff.
The works,
my friend. And so, if, you know, it is doubtlessly true that many, many people believed the exchange in which they entered spiritual enlightenment for physical labor was a fair one, right? Mm-hmm. And you can see interviews of people saying this is the most important thing happening to humanity now. And for some people, that's inspiring. For other people, and I would count myself amongst this latter group, that's chilling. But we know that some of these Rolls-Royces are still around in the hands of private collectors.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, maybe one of you out there has seen one or driven one or experienced enlightenment due to the amazing suspension.
Yeah, maybe. Enlightenment due to the suspension, right? So you could travel like Buddha wants you to travel.
Oh, gosh. I'm trying my best.
But you're going to hell, Ben.
You know what?
No doubt about it.
That's where all my friends will be hanging out.
Hey, you know what's funny? We're talking about this like it's something that's in the past, but they still run a commune. The commune exists tonight, today.
That's true.
And if you go to, if you look up that clip that I mentioned, that, you know, that good luck to you and your pimps. That interview. If you look that up, you will see that even today, I watched it again today because it's funny and uncomfortable to watch. I'll tell you that.
Gosh.
But if you watch that, and look in the comments. Today, somebody had commented, I think it was 10 hours ago. So there's active members of this community that are still searching out stuff like that and still defending the views expressed in that clip. And
right.
If somebody writes anything that says anything otherwise, they are then quickly, you know, reprimanded in those comments by someone that is of that faith and of that community.
Right.
And you'll see it's like an active thing. So there's people out there that are still involved in, like, you know, searching out media about this and trying to right the wrongs that are the messages that are delivered about Osho in the media. And you know, whether they're right or wrong, that's all in your point of view. But
right.
The arguments are still happening today.
Also, you know, you and I and Noel the Movement Brown believe that people's spirituality should be their own decision. It's a private decision. We would never tell somebody what to believe. You know, I know some of our listeners even like Honda Odysseys, and I've dealt with that, and that's their decision to make.
That's their own type of cult. Their own. Okay. Yeah, you're right. No, teach their own. Right. We have said that from the very beginning. And if this is the kind of thing that you're interested in, we're not downplaying that in any way. But some people see it a different way.
What a fascinating story, though. The rise and fall of the largest Rolls Royce collection in the world to this day, I believe.
You know, it's unbelievable. You would think that there would be a chic somewhere that would have more than this at this point. But this was, and I don't know, maybe at this point in history, maybe there is somebody that has more.
Yeah.
However, this is the one that got the most media attention. This is the first one, really, that garnered worldwide attention, that drew the eyes of the world, really, to this small little town in Oregon and what was happening. And I guess the outrage of the locals, you have to really dig into this to understand what we're saying about this and how the people felt it was such a disruption. Again, that magazine that I mentioned, Oregon Magazine, 1859, or some combination of that. If you search there for information about this, you're going to find some interesting history tidbits and things that we didn't describe here today or talk to you about. But fascinating.
Man, I love when we get a chance to look at bizarre or little known car collections, you know, like the car collections of Middle Eastern billionaires. It's always fascinating.
And this was so short-lived. This is a four-year period where he amassed this collection, or 4 or 5 years, and then it was just gone. It was dissolved because of the breakdown of the imploding of this commune. Very strange.
Mm-hmm. And we'd like to hear from you, listeners. Are there any car collections that you think your fellow Car Stuff listeners should know about? If so, we would love to cover them. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Car Stuff HSW, and you just might see a video of a very awkward interview from Perth, Australia, back in the day.
Yeah, very awkward.
Yeah, and oh, man, I'm cracking up thinking about it. I'm going to go watch it after we get off the air.
Me too.
You can also check out some of our episodes on unusual car collections, along with every other podcast we have ever covered, at our website, carstuffshow.com. And if you've got something else you'd like to say, maybe an important automotive event coming up that you'd like listeners to know about, maybe a topic that you would like us to investigate in the future, or a story of your own strange encounter with an odd car collection, we'd love to hear that too. You can write to us directly at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.